This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Especially if the professional interviews done between an interviewer at a media organization and an interviewee who works for, you know, some kind of arts organization, a film company, a book publisher, they're trying to promote something. So ideally, the best kind of conversation is where those two people can talk about the thing that's being promoted, but also then you're able to talk a little bit about the personal aspects of the things that make them share what it means to be human, not only with each other, but with the audience that's listening.
How'd you get into this?
Well, I was an interviewer for Armed Forces Television and radio for a long time. And then before that, I worked for radio stations in St. Louis and Massachusetts. I also worked for the Cincinnati Inquirer, a newspaper in Cincinnati. And then I did a lot of freelance work. I did some work with the United Way and produced a couple of small documentaries, one about AIDS. And then I've also written a lot of articles, so I've had to do a lot of interviewing of people for freelance articles that I've written. So my interviewing experience is pretty much across the board. Oh, and I was also a public affairs officer for the federal government for a while, so I was also responsible for doing media and helping them get good publicity. So there again, more interviewing experience, more talking to people experience.
If you had to guess, how many people have you talked to for media?
Probably several hundred, at least.
Who was your first interview with?
My first interview was when I was working for Armed Forces Television in Korea. And that was probably 25 years ago. An interview that my news director had sent me out because I had just arrived in country and there was a contest on post. And it was a contest where all the men would get up on stage and they would walk around on stage and the women would judge who had the prettiest legs. It was called the Mr. Legs Contest.
Hard-hitting journalism.
And so, well, you know what? It's not always hard-hitting and it's not always journalism. But I remember I went there and I talked to a couple of those guys. And it was just fun. So if I had to think, my first interview for a broadcast media, I think that would probably be it.
In his book Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell explores the myth of the self-made man. He says that successful people often have special opportunities because they're in the right place at the right time. What are some of the lucky breaks you've had?
Well, I would have to say that one of the luckiest breaks I had was coming into Armed Forces Television, Armed Forces Broadcasting, because Armed Forces Broadcasting, at least then, was set up in such a way to where you could, it's a lot like cable, you come with a willingness to learn. There are people who are willing to teach you, and then whatever opportunity you want to take up is available if you're willing to take it up, if you're willing to do the work. And usually people get out of your way as long as you're not breaking anything or, you know, initiating any lawsuits against the station. And that's how it was with Armed Forces Broadcasting. Most of the people who end up in military broadcasting go through a school called DINFOS, which is called an acronym for the Defense Information School. It used to be in Indianapolis, but now I think it's in California somewhere or Arizona. I'm not really sure where it is. But anyway, that was a school that sort of gave you the basics of broadcasting and journalism, microphone technique, interviewing technique, how to use equipment. Also, it taught you a little bit about human psychology. Because when you're talking to people, you have to use a lot of the same cues you use in everyday life when you're interacting with people. But in an interview, it's a little bit more intense because you're trying to get people to tell you something that they wouldn't normally tell you. And so you sort of have to understand how to approach people, how to ask questions, how to know when to back off, that kind of thing. So I would say that the military broadcasting experience was really a good one for me because it gave me exposure to lots of different people and lots of different situations in lots of different places around the world.
How does that compare to the learning process that KBOO presents for its volunteers?
It's very similar. It's really not that much different. KBOO, you know, has the facilities. It has the people who are willing to do the training. And it certainly has the opportunity for you to put that training to work. If I had to identify it as a genre, I would say community radio in general is a really great opportunity for people to not only learn about broadcasting and how to interact with people, but to apply that stuff in the field in real time.
You just mentioned in your training with Armed Forces that you learned about psychology
a little bit
in interviews.
Yeah.
In your blog, Vox Pop, you write, "The job of a good interviewer is to triangulate a reveal, to use good intelligence, i.e. good research, to help the listener draw a picture of what the interviewee does and doesn't want you to know." What are the most startling reveals you've triangulated?
The one thing about doing an interview, when you ask somebody a question that they're not prepared for and they say they don't know off the top of their head, a lot of times they really don't know off the top of their head. It's sort of like when you're trying to remember the name of a movie around a group of friends and you remember it at 3 o'clock in the morning when everybody else is in bed asleep. It's sort of like that. So I can't really think of a reveal that is really profound, although I do remember one. Not long ago, I interviewed one of the members of Air Supply. He was talking about interviews, and he was saying that sometimes you don't want to talk to somebody who didn't take the time to do the research. And he said that his partner has gotten up in the middle of bad interviews and left. Because his partner said that if you don't even know what kind of music we do, then I can tell you right now, this interview is not going to go well. So why don't you take some time to collect your thoughts? And we will be willing to do this again. And to me, that showed that Air Supply, the music is very soft rockish and very, very comforting. There's a very hard edge to those two because, you know, they've been in business for 30, 35 years doing music. And so they don't really have the time to waste with people who don't take them seriously. Another reveal that I didn't discover, but I heard through another interviewer was Lindsay Lohan not long ago. Lindsay Lohan did an interview with David Letterman. And Lindsay Lohan had been on David Letterman's show probably 4 or 5 times in her whole career. Started out with him. I think The Parent Trap was one of the first movies she was in. And now, of course, she's having a lot of problems. She got on the David Letterman show, and they were talking, you know, like they usually talk. But then I guess David Letterman decided, you know, I'm close enough to Lindsay Lohan that I can sort of ask her some hard questions. And so he started asking her questions, and you could see by the look on her face that she was kind of surprised. And she said in the course of the interview, "We didn't talk about this in the pre-interview," which sort of gives you an insight as to how interviews go usually. Usually there's a pre-interview where people sort of get an idea of what's going to be talked about, and then there's the interview. Well, apparently David Letterman had sort of left this little tidbit out of the pre-interview. And when it was time to sort of put pin Lindsay Lohan up to the carpet, he was trying more or less to get her to own up to the fact that she hadn't really been behaving very professionally. After the interview, I mean, sometimes interviews go bad and people jump up off the stage and storm out and, you know, there's all these recriminations. But in her case, she tweeted afterwards that she was really glad she had gone on and she, you know, still loves David Letterman. And that was a reveal because what it showed was, one, I mean, everybody knows what David Letterman is capable of, including her handler. So if they send her on an interview with David Letterman, they pretty much know that he's capable of anything. And she probably knew it, too. And a lot of times, I think good interviewers give people an opportunity to give penance. If they know they're doing wrong or if they know they've let people down or if they know they aren't living up to their reputation, and they want to apologize, but they don't know how. Sometimes a good interviewer can give them that opportunity. And I think that's what David Letterman did. And that was a reveal.
You just mentioned a couple of things that can go awry during an interview, people getting up and walking out. The Icelandic band Sigur Rós had a notoriously disastrous interview on NPR's Bryant Park Project. They were really nice, but they weren't able to articulate anything about their music or their process for the listeners, and they were being asked really penetrating questions about their music. Now, Bill O'Reilly, on The O'Reilly Factor, screams at his guests and he'll cut off their mics, but the Sigur Rós example shows that an awful interview can still be really civilized. What was the worst interview you've ever done, and why didn't it work?
I've done a lot of interviews, and a lot of them are public affairs interviews, and I've done a lot of news interviews, too. I wouldn't say that this is the worst interview that I've had, but it sort of falls into a class of interviews. I mean, news interviews specifically. Like I said earlier, I mean, if you're talking to somebody who has something that they want to tell people about, then they're going to talk about it. Because if you have something you want to talk to people about, then they're going to talk about it because it's in their best interest. It's in the best interest of the organization they represent to talk about this thing, to get it publicity, to get people to buy it or see it or whatever. But sometimes in news, that's not always true. And in news, you can sometimes try to have a conversation with somebody who doesn't want to have a conversation with you. And this seems to happen most often. And this really kind of amazes me. Of course, it makes perfect sense because it's how humans are. You know, they want to talk about the good stuff. They don't want to talk about the bad stuff. An organization like a city department or like a business will send you press releases until the cows come home to get you to talk to them about their latest product. But they don't necessarily want to talk to you if they're facing a lawsuit or if one of their employees, you know, got arrested for drunk driving or something like that. And so this class of interviews, you know, organizations that use the media, you know, to their own advantage when they see it fits their purposes.
Do you use a different approach when you're dealing with politicians or activists who don't necessarily want to talk to you versus the artists or creatives or people with messages who do?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I think that with the politicians and not so much the activists, because activists in this culture, sometimes activists are marginalized. And so they're always looking for an opportunity to talk, and they will always talk about what their passion is. There's never any problem with getting an activist to talk. But getting a politician to talk or a member of government or someone from law enforcement, it's always difficult to talk because the first thing they're thinking of is money. Because if you get somebody to say something and give their real name and their real position, then what they are being is a spokesperson for the organization. And if they end up saying something that makes their organization liable for something else, then that may end up in a lawsuit somewhere, you know, and that means money. And the first thing an organization is concerned with, especially a governmental organization or a business, the first thing they're concerned about is reducing money losses. And so however that translates, whether it means, you know, reducing the amount of information that they give out or editing the information heavily so that it contains almost nothing of value, that's their first concern. Talking to celebrities, like I said earlier, it's almost never the case where they won't talk to you about their art or their craft or whatever. It's more difficult to get celebrities sometimes to talk about their personal life. Like, for instance, when you talk to an author and the author has written a novel and the novel is about X, and then you ask the author, well, weren't you involved in something like X? And the novelist will say, well, yes, but there really isn't a whole lot of my personal life in here. Well, you can pretty much guarantee that there's a good portion of their personal life in there, but they're not going to admit it because, you know, they don't necessarily want you to know that much about them. Or, you know, it might be literary fiction where they are sort of drawing on their own life as a basis, but then they sort of branch off into different directions. But still, you know, a good piece of who they are is in there. So the celebrity interview versus the government or the official interview, it can be very different. You're right.
How do you manage an interview when you don't like your subject's material or message?
Well, there's two ways to deal with that. Sort of like if you don't like the message, but you feel that it's your responsibility as an interviewer to expose your audience to a wide range of subjects and topics and people, then you go into it like that. I mean, you may not necessarily agree with the topic or the interviewer or the product or whatever, but the goal as an interviewer, you're sort of serving a higher purpose, and that is to help this person explain themselves, explain what it is about what they do that makes them want to do it. And you don't necessarily have to agree because you're not really serving yourself. You're serving your audience, and you're serving the person who's there.
It's interesting that you mentioned David Letterman, Jon Stewart, for example. I think the fact that they're comedians kind of disarms their guests a little bit. Mm-hmm. Jon Stewart has done some unbelievable interviews when he suddenly switches into a sincere mode.
Absolutely.
Demonstrates how really smart and engaged he is. He's just not a clown.
I'm glad you mentioned that because successful interviewers all have a bit of jester in them. And I believe very strongly in the concept of jester. Historically, the jester was the only one who could speak truth to power without getting his head cut off by the king. That's why comedians are able to get to the point because they disarm people. And so when people's defenses are down, then the comedian hits them with something serious. Weekend Update on SNL is so poignant and pointed because while it's making fun of something, it's also going straight to the heart of something. Interview and intervention do have a common root. Just because you're talking to somebody and you're talking about ordinary stuff doesn't mean the stuff you're talking about isn't sincere, isn't important, isn't deep. I really think that people who have a basis in comedy, like David Letterman or like Jay Leno or Craig Ferguson, They make excellent interviewers, too.
In the 24-hour news cycle, wall-to-wall interviews, wall-to-wall commentary, who would you love to confiscate a microphone from?
I would say the screamers. The people like Bill O'Reilly, and also the TV talk show hosts. Some of the TV talk show hosts who are also interviewers really kind of focus on the worst of people. Jerry Springer, I would say he's at the top. But he has a very loyal following. I mean, there have been several movies written about the way Jerry Springer draws people out. Now, there's a difference between drawing out people who want to be drawn out and drawing out people who don't want to be drawn out. I think the second one is a harder skill to have. Because the first one really is people who are just trying to sell themselves, and they will do it any way they can. And I mean, if anyone's ever watched an episode of Jerry Springer, you know that's true. By contrast, for someone who is able to draw somebody out and get them to share themselves in a sincere way about something and then feel good that they did it afterwards, that's the real skill.
Okay, I'm going to give you the keys to the TARDIS. You can go anywhere in time and space. You have a universal translator and a field recorder. Who do you want to talk to?
Jesus. I want to talk to Jesus.
What would you ask Jesus?
I would ask Jesus, do you realize what has been done in your name? If you could know what was done in your name, what would you do differently now? I remember I was in school and I was reading about World War I and how on both sides of the front, Orthodox Catholic priests were praying to God for victory. And I'm like, do you see this? I mean, this is what free will has wrought. I mean, did you guys really think this through? That's what I would ask Jesus. I mean, I wouldn't ask about the miracles. I wouldn't ask about anything else. I would ask about that because that really is the basis of everything else.
So what are you learning now in your interviewing career and what skills are you working to improve?
Well, I guess one of the things that I'm trying to learn and remember is that just because I talk to these people doesn't mean I know them. The thing about talking to famous people and having conversations with famous people is it's easy to be able to say, oh yeah, I talked to Ziggy Marley not long ago, and he and I, and people would go, oh, really, you talked to Ziggy Marley? But really it doesn't. I mean, it means something, but it doesn't, because Ziggy Marley is an institution, and he's been an institution for decades, and he has his own universe. And I was granted access to that universe, but I am in no way a member of that universe. And I think that people who do interviews, who talk with famous people, need to understand that they are granting you a luxury. I can't remember the name of the guy right now, but he has made a reputation for interviewing, and he's doing his interviews in his garage. He's very famous right now. He had a mental break. He got divorced. He lost his job and his means to support himself. And then he started doing these interviews, and he's been able to interview a lot of really famous people. And he talks a lot about that. He says, you know, just because I've talked to these people, it doesn't mean that they would want to invite me over to watch them paint their bedroom or something. I mean, it's not that kind of relationship. It's just not. And in social media, there's a lot of social media where people are trying to make themselves famous by saying who they can casually name drop. And it's not really about that. You're not being sincere. I would say another thing that I've learned is that I don't really know it all. I mean, I have all this experience with radio and TV and newspapers and magazines, and I have all this experience. You know, you would assume that because I have all this experience, it means, well, obviously, I know how to do this perfectly well all the time. And I don't, because I'm human and I make mistakes. And, you know, I listen to something that I said or a question I asked, and I think, oh, God, that was a rookie mistake. Why did I say that? Why did I do that? And so you just learn to pay more attention. Even as an interviewer, I say a lot. And so I think, how can I stop doing that? I tend to smack when I talk. Things that you hear yourself do and you think, that's not how I want to sound. That's not how I want to present myself. I always want to be flowing and cogent, like someone skipping across the Elysian Fields, and it's just not that way. It's just not that way. I have to be kinder with myself. And I think being kinder with myself helps me to have more sympathy and compassion with the people I'm talking to. Because whether it's a news interview or a public affairs interview, sometimes I talk to people and I hear them say something and I think, wow, I would never. And then I think, oh, yes, you would. Oh, yes, you would. So don't judge. So that's another thing. You know, talking to people, like I said at the very beginning, an interview is a conversation between two people where you're trying to be as sincere as possible. And a lot of times that sincerity depends a lot on human empathy. Before you go into a conversation with somebody, it's important to not judge what they do say and what they don't say. Because it could, whatever the situation, it could just as easily be you.
Well, Don, that was fascinating. Thank you very much for talking to me about talking to people.
Rand, it was a pleasure.
You are listening to KBOO coming up this morning, Radio Zine. We hear a story from the series Between the Lines on the Congressional Progressives campaign to restore FDR-era Glass-Steagall Act, followed shortly by noon headlines and moving on. So keep it locked right here, KBOO Portland.
A just-released report from Public Citizen titled Safety Glass marks the 80th anniversary of the enactment of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial and investment banking in the aftermath of the Great Depression. On June 16, 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt signed the Banking Act, also known as Glass-Steagall, that created the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The legislation was a product of a negotiated agreement, whereby the federal government would guarantee funds deposited in banks in exchange for mandating that all banks sell off their investment divisions, keeping commercial banking functions like loans made to consumers and businesses separate from risky investment activity. However, in the late 1990s, pressure began to build on Congress to rescind Glass-Steagall prohibitions. In 1999, President Bill Clinton signed the Financial Modernization Act, supported by Texas GOP Senator Phil Graham and then Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, that repealed Glass-Steagall. Many economists assert that the death of Glass-Steagall set the stage for the boom and bust that took down the U.S. and much of the world's economy in 2008. Your reporter spoke with Bartlett Naylor, financial policy analyst with Public Citizens Congress Watch, who formerly served as chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. Here he talks about the effort now underway in Congress to restore the FDR-era Glass-Steagall Act.
Marcy Kaptur, a long-serving progressive Democrat from Toledo, Ohio, has for two Congresses introduced basically a restoration of Glass-Steagall. In the 112th Congress, which expired last December, she recruited 125 co-sponsors of her bill out of the 435 House members, including three Republicans. This Congress, she introduced the bill in January and has already amassed, as of last look, it keeps getting a couple every day, of last look, she has 65 co-sponsors, so she has a year and a half to go. That won't be given the light of day, for political reality. It will not be afforded a vote in the House Banking Committee or of the full House because she's a Democrat. But it does have some bipartisan support, although only three or four Republicans are among those 65. More importantly, in the Senate, here's a prediction. You're hearing inside information first. Within a few weeks, I predict Elizabeth Warren will introduce her Glass-Steagall bill. She has completely changed the dynamic of the Senate Banking Committee because whereas many of these senators bring particular skills to the Banking Committee, none of them are the nation's leading scholars on banking, and that is Elizabeth Warren. She will introduce, I predict, a bill on Glass-Steagall. The Kaptur bill has already been introduced by Tom Harkin, the Democratic senator from Iowa. In public statements, a number of other R's and D's, Republicans and Democrats, have voiced their support for Glass-Steagall, including Richard Shelby, an otherwise very conservative senator from Alabama. Joe Manchin, who is a moderate Democrat from West Virginia, Marie Cantwell, Democrat, a fairly progressive Democrat from the state of Washington. I would say there's a dozen Democrats who are on record in support of Glass-Steagall. If you'll permit me a little inside baseball, the problem is that the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Tim Johnson, wisely understands that if he reopens a major banking law such as Dodd-Frank, he is vulnerable to moderate Democrats joining with Republicans who will dilute Dodd-Frank and therefore opening it to something as dramatic as Glass-Steagall could blow up and go the wrong way, because those Wall Street contributions and lobby dollars have got quite a grip on Washington, including the democratically controlled Senate.
We'll trigger a new financial collapse in the near future if we don't get serious about this and beat back the lobbyists. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to say that the London Whale and the guy that destroyed Barings Bank, that the LIBOR scandal, that's we're done. There will be no more bank explosions, that history won't repeat itself. But unfortunately, it's been repeating itself since well before the tulip bubble in the Netherlands. Unfortunately, it is inevitable. It's a matter of when is it going to be. I actually was just speaking with a senior official of the FDIC, and he told me there's something happening very soon. So I'm sorry to be alarmist, but I don't know if it's next week or next month or next year, but without strict financial oversight, we are doomed to financial buccaneers.
That was Bartlett Naylor, financial policy analyst with Public Citizens Congress Watch. To download a copy of Public Citizens Safety Glass report and related articles, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop, from the birth of rock and roll to the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO.